Welcome to the 2 Degrees Show, the UK's weekly show dedicated to climate change. We're very privileged this week to have an interview with award-winning journalist George Monbiot about his new book entitled Heat: How to Stop the Planet Burning. It's a visionary action plan for decarbonising the UK over the next 25 years, and we're going to go straight into it. Speaking to Dr. Alice Bowes a couple of weeks ago, who was looking at something like a 70% cut in carbon emissions by 2050 for Friends of the Earth. You're looking at a much steeper target than that. Can you explain how you've arrived at it?
Yes, the great majority of the world's climate scientists now agree that 2 degrees of warming represents a critical threshold. If the global temperature rises by more than 2 degrees above the pre-industrial level, then all sorts of really disastrous impacts start to occur. For one thing, the places which have the capacity to release a great deal more carbon into the atmosphere start releasing it. In other words, in Siberia, the permafrost begins to melt, and the methane trapped in the permafrost, which is a very powerful greenhouse gas, is released. In the Amazon, the trees start to die back, and the carbon that they contain turns into carbon dioxide and is released into the atmosphere. So, in other words, if we let global temperatures get to 2 degrees above the pre-industrial level, they will go to 3 degrees or go to 4 degrees. And there are all sorts of other major problems which kick off at that level. So we have to stop global temperatures reaching 2 degrees above the pre-industrial level. In order to do that, and have a high chance of doing that, we have to ensure that the concentration of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere doesn't rise above 400 parts per million, 400 parts of the carbon dioxide per million parts of atmospheric gases. And what that requires is a 60% global cut by 2030, which means in rich nations like the UK, a 90% cut by 2030. Now, that's a much steeper trajectory than the one put forward by Alice Bowes and others, but they were using a concentration, a target concentration in the atmosphere of 450 parts per million of carbon dioxide, and we now know perfectly well that 450 parts per million, you have a low chance or at the very best a medium chance of ensuring that temperatures don't get to 2 degrees above the pre-industrial level. So it's the wrong target.
Yeah, in their conclusions they actually recognise that as well. They kind of quote the Mindshausen study and say that, I've got it here, the latest scientific understanding of correlations between concentration and temperature suggests that even at 400 parts per million CO2, there's approximately a 50% chance of exceeding the 2 degrees target. Yeah. So Tyndall Centre aren't at odds with you, but they've just been asked to do something that's not that challenging by Friends of the Earth.
That's correct, and yeah. Friends of the Earth set the wrong criteria for their study.
And I asked Alice Bowes briefly about your target of 90% cut by 2030, and she concurred that would provide a greater chance of staying within the 2 degree C range.
Right, yeah. We are on the same side, and I greatly admire the people at the Tyndall Centre, including her.
Okay. So, it's an extraordinarily big ask, your big ask, 90% by 2030. But you believe that by the end of the book you've pretty much shown that can be done in almost every sector. Perhaps we can break it down into the different sectors and see how you think it can be done.
Sure.
You started off by looking at behaviour change and carbon rationing you think would provide a range of incentives for people to change their behaviour.
Yes, I've chosen carbon rationing as the framework within which all the other changes take place. And the reason for that is, several reasons, but the main one is that it's a much fairer system than the other systems we might devise, and it allows us much more freedom as well. You could alternatively, for instance, have sort of carbon police who go around to your house every night and say, you haven't switched your TV off at the wall, or you've been using your washing machine too much today, and it would be incredibly intrusive, and no one would put up with that. Alternatively, you could say, let's do it by taxing carbon use to a great extent, and you could achieve the desired result in terms of carbon emissions, but it would mean that the poor would pretty well cease to use energy while the rich could continue to do so. Now, under carbon rationing, you could you'll see a situation where the rich will still use more energy than the poor, but they have to pay the poor a great deal of money in order to do so. The idea is this, that everyone gets an equal share of carbon dioxide, which comes down a little bit every year until we reach the right target. But if you use more than your share and you want to carry on using carbon-based energy, then you've got to buy extra carbon rations from someone who's used less than their share. And as generally the rich use more energy than the poor, there'll be a transfer of wealth from the rich to the poor.
Right. And that also starts to stimulate demand for low-carbon technologies as well.
It does, because then you have a powerful incentive to stay within your carbon ration as much as possible, and companies have a powerful incentive to sell you things which allow you to do that without having to make a drastic change in your life. So, for example, you could see how that would be an instant incentive for much more energy-efficient light bulbs and home appliances, because you could then keep the lights on while staying within your carbon ration, whereas if you use the old-fashioned incandescent light bulbs, your carbon ration is going to run out pretty quickly. But I do point out in the book that that's not enough, that just having carbon rationing and then leaving it to the market won't work, because there's some massive infrastructural changes are required if we're going to get to this 90% cut in carbon emissions, and those require action from the government.
Right. So you're also looking, in terms of behaviour change, looking at regulation and public information campaigns.
We badly need both of those. A classic example where we need regulation in order to make it easier for everyone to stay within their carbon budget is when it comes to building standards. Now, we already have building regulations in this country, but they are totally pathetic. They are worse than they were in Sweden in 1978, as far as energy efficiency is concerned. And they are also completely unenforced. Our energy efficiency regulations were introduced in 1985, and since then there has not been a single prosecution for non-compliance, not one anywhere in the country. And that's not because all the builders are complying with the regulations. There was a recent survey of builders which found that the majority are not complying with the energy efficiency regulations. And so we need much, much tighter rules, not just for building new homes, but for refurbishing existing ones.
Right. So obviously that was the first thing you looked at, because if you reduce the energy demands of the home, then the amount of carbon-free electricity we need to produce comes down drastically. What kind of cut do you think is possible in terms of energy efficiency around the home?
Some environmentalists have claimed that you could get an 80 or 90% cut by improving energy efficiency in the home, and unfortunately it's simply not true when you look right across the whole housing stock. And part of the reason for that is we live in really cruddy old homes in this country. We've got the oldest housing stock in Western Europe, and it's in the worst condition. And a lot of the homes are basically beyond effective repair. And yet we have a very low turnover rate as well. The demolition and rebuilding rate means it would take 1,700 years to replace the houses in this country, which is a bit beyond our time frame. And so it seems that on the best estimates, we could probably get a cut of 30 to 40% by means of energy efficiency alone.
So for new homes, you're calling for all new homes to be of the passive house standard?
Yes. Now for new homes, there's much more scope for getting a really massive cut in energy use. There's this, you mentioned this German passive house standard. It's not a particular design of house, but it's a standard for building homes, which means that you require no heating or cooling system in the house. You don't require central heating or fan heaters or air conditioners or anything like that for two main reasons. One, it's built with enormous care so that there are no what is called thermal bridges, no conductive materials running from the inside of the house to the outside of the house. At every point there's insulation to prevent heat from going one way or the other. The other thing is that the windows are very cleverly and carefully matched to the size of the house, so that what's called the passive solar gain, the heating you get from the sun, is just the right amount for the house. And in Germany, where the houses of this kind were originally built, even in the harsh German winter, they don't go below 19 degrees centigrade. And in the summer, they tend not to go above 24 degrees. And so they maintain a very constant temperature, heated exclusively by sunlight coming through the glass and by the body heat of the people who live in them. And you do not need any other system. And I would like to see us in the UK moving to a system where every single new home that is built must be built to the passive house standard. Mm. And while it costs between 7 to 10% more than ordinary homes, the payback is pretty rapid, and so the people who live in those homes would actually make that money back fairly fast.
Mm. And the government's got a target of building 1.2 million homes by 2016, so they could all be of this standard.
It's a tremendous opportunity, mm. and if we don't take that opportunity, there's a tremendous problem building here, because we need to cut emissions by 90% across the entire housing stock. And if the housing stock is increasing while we're trying to make that cut, well, you can see why that cut becomes harder and harder. But if we have every new house being a passive house, then that certainly takes a lot of the pressure off.
Mm. That's a small proportion of the total stock still, isn't it? So what about all the rented accommodation, for example?
Well, we have a particular problem with rented accommodation, because the people who might gain from energy efficiency measures are not the people who would pay for those measures. And so the landlord has very little incentive to help his tenants to save energy. And what's required here, I think, are much stricter rules for landlords. At the moment, you say to a landlord, you can't rent out a house unless it's got fire doors and ways of escaping from a fire and stuff, and that's all fine. To that should be added various rules about energy efficiency. You cannot rent this house out until it meets a certain energy efficiency standard.
Hmm. And presumably that could also apply to housing associations and shared ownership schemes.
Yes, it has to apply across the board. Hmm. And basically, if anyone is acting as a free rider, in as far as climate change is concerned, everyone else has to make bigger cuts. So this must apply to everybody.
The energy use in terms of kind of gadgets and electrical appliance around the home is also on the increase. Some of that would be dealt with by carbon rationing, I guess.
Yes, there would be a powerful incentive to have more energy efficient gadgets. And that means, for instance, to not to buy plasma screen TVs, which are 5 times as energy consuming as cathode ray tube TVs, to switch to fridges and freezers which have vacuum insulated panels, which are far more efficient than the ordinary fridges and freezers but are almost unobtainable at the moment, not to have patio heaters, not to have air conditioning, but to switch to LED light bulbs and a whole lot of other very good new technologies which are now available but which are hardly ever bought and which are in fact extremely hard to buy. We tried to buy a freezer recently. We'd done without one for a long time, but now we've got a baby, it's hard to get by without one. And we spent 3 days searching for an A++ freezer, which is the top of the range, and found that they do not exist in the United Kingdom. You cannot get hold of one.
Right. Maybe we've got time to fit in the other two main areas, transport and the remaining
electricity that needs to be provided. Yes. How do we decarbonise our electricity supply? You actually seem to think that carbon capture and storage provides a good solution. How easy is it to bolt on that technology to the or existing power plants?
It's not very easy to bolt it on to existing power plants. It's much easier to fit it to new power plants. Basically, the technology is a means of extracting carbon dioxide from the exhaust of the power stations, piping it away and burying it in underground rock formations like old gas fields or saline aquifers. And the advantage we have in proposing this is that the great majority of power stations will need to be replaced between now and 2030. And it seems to me that every gas-burning power station, and I think we can do away with coal-burning power stations, every gas-burning power station must be fitted with carbon capture and storage technology. Now, it seems to me, having written the book and received quite a few comments and seen some recent scientific papers, that I might have been a bit over-optimistic about the potential for carbon capture and storage, and it's not quite as ready to be applied as I hoped it was, and so I'm concerned that I might have overemphasized it. I supplement this in my proposals with a massive investment in renewables, and I take the opposite position to that of many environmentalists. Many people have been calling for the decentralization of energy and the production of energy locally by means of rooftop solar panels and micro wind turbines and the rest of it, and the scrapping of the national grid. I want to go in exactly the opposite direction, and the reason for this is that I believe that your renewable power sources should be put where there's most ambient energy. And in our cities, for example, rooftop micro wind turbines are a total waste of time and money. They simply do not produce anything like the energy that the people who have been selling them claim. You get about 5% maximum from an average sized micro turbine of your household electricity demand. Instead, we would need to go to exactly the opposite scale and build as big as possible. And I suggest huge offshore wind farms with turbines maybe going up to 10 megawatts, I mean really enormous wind turbines, and to start making use of very large areas of the continental shelf. They'll be out of sight, so they won't upset people with the visual intrusion, and you can bring the electricity in by means of high voltage direct current cables, which can operate over a very long distance because they don't lose electricity in transmission. And by use of those cables, you can start tapping into much wider sources than before. You can make use of a much wider area of seabed, and so that means that you're more likely to get reliable wind resources at any one time. And you can also, they can be long enough to start building the European grid outwards towards the Sahara and making use of vast solar farms in the Sahara. And if you have solar farms in both the eastern and the western Sahara, you could produce reliable, renewable electricity for about 15 hours a day.
And you discuss nuclear power and put that pretty much at the bottom of your list of priorities.
I suppose my primary reason for it is as follows, that while a lot of the environmentalist arguments against nuclear power don't really apply anymore, for instance, in a new generation of nuclear power stations, there will not be another Chernobyl. That seems to be very clear now. It is also the case that the technology exists to dispose of nuclear waste safely in certain circumstances. The question being whether it will actually be done that way or whether corners will be cut, that's another question. But my reason for still holding out against nuclear power is as follows, that one of the other things I'd like to see is eventual multilateral nuclear disarmament. I'd like to see all nations scrapping their nuclear weapons, as I think most people in the world would like to see. And it's become clear to me that that is impossible if we retain nuclear power, because all the nations which have acquired or tried to acquire nuclear weapons since the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty was signed have done so by diverting materials from their civil nuclear programs. So if you retain a civil nuclear program, you will have nuclear weapons. It seems as simple as that.
Moving on to road transport.
Yeah.
What's the potential for encouraging high efficiency vehicles on the road by ramping up the legal fuel efficiency of our cars?
Well, there is incredible potential here. It's profoundly ironic that the top performing car in terms of miles per gallon in Britain today is the Toyota Prius. Or Prius, I'm never quite sure how you pronounce it. In 1983, Peugeot was producing a car which was much more energy efficient. It was a standard Peugeot 205 in 1983, was doing, 72 miles to the gallon, whereas the Toyota Prius does 51. And there's no technological hurdle here. There's no technological difficulty in making much more efficient cars. The problem is that people are demanding bigger cars with bigger engines, better performance, and, you know, in other words, faster acceleration and all the rest of it. And that's completely incompatible with energy efficiency. And again, it's only going to happen through government putting pressure on the manufacturers and indeed through carbon rationing. But there's also other ways of making of decarbonising even car transport, and I'm not a great fan of car transport at the best of times, but it can be made much more energy efficient than it is at the moment. And one of those is to turn your network of filling stations into a network of battery replacement stations. And the way I see it is, you could have a fleet of electric cars. In other words, you or I could own an electric car, and as the battery begins to run down, you pull into a filling station, a crane comes over, cranks out the old battery, sticks in a new one, and off you go. And you basically lease your battery from the network of filling stations. And that allows them then to charge the batteries overnight with surplus electricity from our offshore wind farms, because at night our demand for electricity falls right back. They can use that free electricity for charging the batteries, and you basically then have more or less carbon-free driving. And it would be incredibly easy by comparison to, say, this crazy hydrogen car network which the EU and the US are talking about.
Talking of alternative fuels, you think that biofuels are quite dangerous, and that EU policies to increase their use could actually be resulting in producing more carbon emissions rather than less? Can you explain what's happening there?
Yes, the biofuels as they stand at the moment are a total disaster for two reasons. The first is that they set up a direct competition between feeding cars and feeding people.
That's because of land use?
Because of the land use, that's right. You're either producing grain for cars, turning into biodiesel or bioethanol for fueling cars, or you're producing grain for feeding people. And we've already seen a situation in which grain prices have risen significantly this year, and according to the UN Food and Agriculture Organization, the primary reason for that is a switch to biofuels. And as grain prices rise, people go hungry. But the second reason, which is even more urgent than the first one, is that many of these biofuels result in the destruction of forests and other great carbon sinks. And the primary example is palm oil, which comes from Malaysia and Indonesia, where it's the primary cause of tropical deforestation in those countries. And we see a huge amount of carbon emissions to the environment caused by cutting down those forests in order to plant palm oil. And it's many, many times as much carbon is released as is saved through using palm oil. And the problem is that palm oil is currently the cheapest source of biodiesel. And so even if you think you're setting up a biodiesel operation which will be sustainable, it will be undercut by the cheaper sources. When the government looked into this, it found that it could do nothing to prevent the import of bad biodiesel, because that would be infringing world trade rules. It's far better not to go down the biodiesel route at all at the moment.
So you also look at a range of other measures to get people out of their cars, and one of the things you look at is a new transport network using deluxe coaches.
Yes, at the moment coach travel is a miserable and humiliating experience, and it takes forever, and that's because it's run on completely stupid and illogical lines. The problem being that the coach stations are in the city centres. If instead you put your coach stations on the junctions of the motorways, and if you have a dedicated coach lane on all the motorways. Overall, you can create a system which is actually faster than the car is at the moment while cutting 90% of emissions. And you could have much more comfortable coaches. Coach travel could actually be a very pleasant way to get about, whereas at the moment it's a deeply unpleasant way to get about.
Moving on to flying. One trip to New York in 2030, you say, is going to represent an entire individual's carbon ration for that year. So obviously we need to almost see an end to that kind of flying in the UK.
Yeah, I mean, unfortunately, there are simply no good technological substitutes for planes and for the fuel that they use, kerosene. And there is no way of getting anywhere near a 90% cut in carbon emissions in the aviation sector whilst keeping the number of planes flying that we have today. And basically a 90% cut in carbon means more or less a 90% cut in flights. And that's what we have to aim for. We simply have to stop flying. And I wish it were otherwise. I wish there were some magical techno fix. But there simply isn't. So we've just got to stop moving over long distances at great speed. Yesterday, for the first time in my life, I did a video conference with some people in Australia. And it worked very well, although to set it up, it turned out that it cost them as much as it would have cost to fly me out, and far more time and trouble to set it up. We need to see video conferencing becoming much more routine, much cheaper. There's absolutely no reason why it shouldn't be dirt cheap, and much, much easier to make use of. And the conference yesterday worked very well. I addressed a hall of a couple of hundred people. I spoke for an hour, and we had an hour of questions and backwards and forwards, and it went very well indeed. It was just as good as being in front of those people and speaking to them in the flesh. And it seems to me that a huge proportion of the journeys we make could be substituted by means such as that. And I got a lot less jet lag as well.
Great. So tax on aviation fuel is outlawed by an international treaty, and also you're saying some 4,000 bilateral agreements.
We've been very foolish to call for an aviation tax on international flights, because it's simply impossible to bring about in the necessary time frame. It would mean unpicking these 4,000 legal agreements, and that just cannot be done within 24 years. And so it seems to me that the only way in which we can do this is by the much more direct means of starting to shut down airport space, shut down landing slots, shut down runways, have far less space for flying in and out of this country than there is at the moment.
Surely this brings us into the realm of political action, and how are governments going to get the political will to tackle vested interests like the aviation industry?
Well, they're going to get it from us. There's nowhere else they can get it from. And they're going to get it from us mobilising on a scale that we haven't mobilised on before, and ensuring that climate change is taken more seriously than any other political issue. And that means that we have to put this at the top of all our political priorities. And I'm not saying to people, give up your job or give up your family life. I am saying give up watching television and spend that time instead campaigning on the world's most pressing problem. We can't leave it to other people. We can't leave it to our MPs. We can't leave it to government. We can't leave it to business to sort this out. We have to sort this out ourselves. No one else is going to do it.
You've been listening to George Monbiot talking about his new book, Heat: How to Stop the Planet Burning, published by Penguin Allen Lane. Next week on the 2 Degrees Show, we'll be getting an update on the massive campaign to get legally binding emissions cuts in the UK. And also to Phil Thornhill, founder and national coordinator of Campaign Against Climate Change, who are coordinating international demonstrations in some 50 countries on the 4th of November, ahead of the UN climate change talks in Nairobi. If you want to hear this show again, the programme will be archived shortly at coinnet, that's coinet.org.uk/climateradio.